It is a NATO team of some sort, but that is only speculation. Now, Popov went on, I have some questions for you.
Okay, the boss nodded.
Did you know of this team? Did you know they existed?
A shake of the head.
No.
Then he turned to pour a cup of coffee.
Is it possible for you to find out some things about them?
A shrug.
Maybe. Why is it important?
That depends on another question.
Why are you paying me to incite terrorists to do things? Popov asked.
You do not have a need to know that, Dmitri.
Yes, sir, I do have such a need.
One cannot stage operations against sophisticated opposition without having some idea of the overall objective.
It simply cannot be done, sir.
Moreover, you have applied significant assets to these operations.
There must be a point. I need to know what it is.
The unspoken part, which got through the words, was that he wanted to know, and in due course he might well figure it out, whether he was told or not. It also occurred to his employer that his existence was somewhat in pawn to this Russian ex-spook. He could deny everything the man might say in an open public forum, and he even had the ability to make the man disappear, an option less attractive than it appeared outside of a movie script, since Popov might well have told others, or even left a written record. The bank accounts from which Popov had drawn the funds he distributed were thoroughly laundered, of course, but there was a trail of sorts that a very clever and thorough investigator might be able to trace back closely enough to him to cause some minor concern. The problem with electronic banking was that there was always a trail of electrons, and bank records were both time-stamped and amount-specific, enough to make some connection appear to exist. That could be an embarrassment of large or small order. Worse, it wasn't something he could easily afford, but a hindrance to the larger mission now underway in places as diverse as New York, Kansas, and Brazil. And Australia, of course, which was the whole point of what he was doing.
Dmitri, will you let me think about that?
Yes, sir, of course. I merely say that if you want me to do my job effectively, I need to know more.
Surely you have other people in your confidence?
Show these tapes to those people and see if they think the information is significant.
Popov stood.
Call me when you need me, sir.
Thanks for the information.
He waited for the door to close, then dialed a number from memory. The phone rang 4 times before it was answered.
Hi, a voice said in the earpiece. You've reached the home of Bill Henriksen. Sorry I can't make it to the phone right now. Why don't you try my office?
Damn, the executive said.
Then he had an idea and picked up the remote for his TV.
CBS. No, NBC.
No.
But to kill a sick child, the host said on ABC's Good Morning America.
Charlie, a long time ago, a guy named Lenin said that the purpose of terrorism was to terrorize. That's who they are, and that's what they do. It's still a dangerous world out there, maybe even more so today, that there are no nation-states who, though they used to support terrorists, actually imposed some restraints on their behavior.
Those restraints are gone now, Henriksen said.
This group reportedly wanted their old friend Carlos the Jackal released from prison.
Well, it didn't work. But it's worth noting that they cared enough to try a classic terrorist mission, to secure the release of one of their own. Fortunately, the mission failed, thanks to the Spanish police.
How would you evaluate the police performance?
Pretty good. They all train out of the same playbook, of course, and the best of them cross-train at Fort Bragg or at Hereford in England, and other places, Germany and Israel, for example.
But one hostage was murdered.
Charlie, you can't stop them all, the expert said sadly. You can be 10 feet away with a loaded weapon in your hands, and sometimes you can't take action, because to do so would only get more hostages killed. I'm as sickened by that murder as you are, my friend, but these people won't be doing any more of that. Well, thanks for coming in. Bill Henriksen, President of Global Security and a consultant to ABC on Terrorism. It's 46 minutes after the hour. Cut to commercial. In his desk, he had Bill's beeper number. This he called, keying in his private line. 4 minutes later, the phone rang. "Yeah, John, what is it?"
There was street noise on the cellular phone. Henriksen must have been outside the ABC studio just off Central Park West, probably walking to his car. "Bill, I need to see you in my office ASAP. Can you come right down?" "Sure. Give me 20 minutes." Henriksen had a clicker to get into the building's garage and access to one of the reserved spaces. He walked into the office 18 minutes after the call.
"What gives?"
"Caught you on TV this morning."
"They always call me in on this stuff," Henriksen said.
"Great job taking the bastards down, least from what the TV footage showed."
"I'll get the rest of it."
"Oh?"
"Yeah, I have the right contacts.
The video they released was edited down quite a bit. My people'll get all the tapes from the Spanish. It isn't classified in any way, for analysis."
"Watch this," John told him, flipping his office TV to the VCR and running the released tape of World Park. Then he had to rise and switch to the cassette of Vienna. 30 seconds of that, and then Bern.
"So, what do you think?"
"The same team on all three?" Henriksen wondered aloud.
"Sure does look like it.
But who the hell are they?"
"You know who Popov is, right?"
Bill nodded.
"Yeah, the KGB guy you found. Is he the guy who twigged to this?"
"Yep."
A nod.
"Less than an hour ago, he was in here to show me these tapes. It worries him."
"Does it worry you?"
The former FBI agent grimaced.
"Not sure.
I'd want to know more about them first."
"Can you find out?"
This time he shrugged.
"I can talk to some contacts, rattle a few bushes.
Thing is, if there is a really black special ops team out there, I should have known about it already. I mean, I've got the contacts throughout the business. What about you?"
"I can probably try a few things, quietly. Probably mask it as plain curiosity."
"Okay, I can check around.
What else did Popov say to you?"
"He wants to know why I'm having him do the things."
That's the problem with spooks. They like to know things.
I mean, he's thinking, what if he starts a mission and one of the subjects gets taken alive? Very often they sing like fucking canaries once they're in custody, John. If one fingers him, he could be in the shitter.
Unlikely, I admit, but possible, and spooks are trained to be cautious.
What if we have to take him out?"
Another grimace.
"You want to be careful doing that in case he's left a package with a friend somewhere. No telling if he has, but I'd have to assume he's done it. Like I said, they're trained to be cautious. This operation is not without its dangers, John. We knew that going in. How close are we to having the technical?"
"Very close.
The test program is moving along nicely. Another month or so, and we'll know all we need to know."
"Well, all I have to do is get the contract for Sydney. I'm flying down tomorrow. These incidents won't hurt."
"Who will you be working with?"
"The Aussies have their own SAS. It's supposed to be small. Pretty well trained, but short on the newest hardware. That's the hook I plan to use."
"I got what they need, at cost," Henriksen emphasized.
"Run that tape again, the one of the Spanish job," he said.
John rose from his desk, inserted the tape, and rewound it back to the beginning of the released TV coverage. It showed the assault team ziplining down from the helicopter.
"Shit, I missed that," the expert admitted.
"What?"
"We need to have the tape enhanced, but that doesn't look like a police chopper. It's a Sikorsky H-60.
"So?"
"So, the 60 has never been certified for civilian use. See how it's got police painted on the side?" That's a civilian application.
It isn't a police chopper, John. It's military.
And if this is a refueling probe, he said, pointing, then it's a special ops bird.
That means U.S. Air Force, man.
That also tells us where these people are based.
Where?
England.
The Air Force has a special ops wing based in Europe, part in Germany, part in England.
MH-60K, I think the designation of the chopper is.
Made for combat search and rescue and getting people into special places to do special things.
Hey, your friend Popoff is right. There is a special bunch of people handling these things. And they've got American support, at least. Maybe a lot more. Thing is, who the hell are they?
It's important.
Potentially, yes.
What if the Aussies call them in to help out on the job I'm trying to get, John?
That could screw up the whole thing.
You rattle your bushes, I'll rattle mine.
Right.
Chapter 17. Bushes. Pete now had 6 friends in the treatment center. Only 2 of the subjects felt well enough now to remain in the open bay with the TV cartoons and the whiskey, and Kilgore figured they'd be in here by the end of the week. So full was their blood with Shiva antibodies. It was odd how the disease attacked different people in such different ways, but everyone had a different immune system. That was why some people got cancer, and others did not, despite smoking and other methods of self-abuse. Aside from that, it was going easier than he'd expected. He supposed it was due to the high doses of morphine that had all of them pretty well zonked out. It was a relatively new discovery in medicine that there really wasn't a maximum safe dosage of painkillers. If the patient still felt pain, you could give more until it went away. Dose levels that would cause respiratory arrest in healthy people were perfectly safe for those in great pain, and that made his job far easier. Every drug dispensing machine had a button the subjects could hit if they needed it, and so they were medicating themselves into peaceful oblivion, which also made things safer for the staffs, who didn't have to do all that many sticks. They hung nutrients on the trees, checked to make sure the IVs were secure, and avoided touching the subjects as much as possible. Later today, they'd all get injected with Vaccine B, which was supposed to safeguard them against Shiva with a high degree of reliability. Steve Berg said 98% to 99%. They all knew that wasn't the same as 100%, though, and so the protective measures would be continued. Agreeably, there was little sympathy for the subjects. Picking winos off the street had been a good call. The next set of test subjects would appear more sympathetic. But everyone in this side of the building had been fully briefed. Much of what they did might be distasteful, but it would still be done.
"You know, sometimes I think the Earth First people are right," Kevin Mayflower said in the Palm restaurant.
"Oh? How so?" Carol Breitling asked.
The president of the Sierra Club looked into his wine.
"We destroy everything we touch. The shores, the tidal wetlands, the forests. Look at what civilization has done to them all."
"Oh, sure, we preserve some areas. And that's what? A hot 3%, maybe?
Big fucking deal. We're poisoning everything, including ourselves. The ozone problem is really getting worse, according to the new NASA study."
"Yeah, but did you hear about the proposed fix?" the president's science advisor asked.
"Fix? How?"
She grimaced.
"Well, you get a bunch of jumbo jets, fill them up with ozone, fly them out of Australia, and release ozone at high altitude to patch it up.
I have that proposal on my desk right now."
"And?"
"And it's like doing abortions at halftime in a football game, with instant replay and color commentary. No way it can possibly work. We have to let the planet heal herself. But we won't, of course."
"Any more good news?"
"Oh, yeah, the CO2 issue. There's a guy up at Harvard who says if we dump iron filings into the Indian Ocean,
we can encourage the growth of phytoplankton, and that will fix the CO2 problem almost overnight. The math looks pretty good. All these geniuses who say they can fix the planet, like she needs fixing, instead of leaving her the hell alone. And the president says what? Mayflower asked.
He says for me to tell him if it'll work or not. And if it looks like it's going to work, then test it to make sure. Then try it for real.
He hasn't got a clue, and he doesn't listen. She didn't add that she had to follow his orders whether she liked them or not.
Well, maybe our friends at Earth First are right, Carol. Maybe we are a parasitic species on the face of the Earth. And maybe we're going to destroy the whole damned planet before we're done.
Rachel Carson come to life, eh? She asked.
Look, you know the science as well as I do. Maybe better. We're doing things like the Alvarez event that took the dinosaurs out. Except we're doing it willfully. It took how long for the planet to recover from that?
Alvarez? The planet didn't recover, Kevin, Carol Breitling pointed out. It jump-started mammals. Us, remember? The pre-existing ecological order never returned. Something new happened, and that took a couple of million years just to stabilize.
Must have been something to see, she told herself. To watch something like that in progress. What a scientific and personal blessing it must have been. But there'd probably been nobody back then to appreciate it. Unlike today.
Well, in a few more years we'll get to see the first part of it, won't we? How many more species will we kill off this year? And if the ozone situation keeps getting worse...
My God, Carol, why don't people get it? Don't they see what's happening? Don't they care?
Kevin, no. They don't see, and no, they don't care. Look around.
The restaurant was filled with important people wearing important-looking clothes, doubtless discussing important things over their important dinners, none of which had a thing to do with the planetary crisis that hung quite literally over all their heads. If the ozone layer really evaporated, as it might, well, they'd start using sunblock just to walk the streets. And maybe that would protect them enough. But what of the natural species, the birds, the lizards, all the creatures on the planet who had no such option? The study suggested that their eyes would be seared by the unblocked ultraviolet radiation, which would kill them off. And so the entire global ecosystem would rapidly come apart.
Do you think any of these people know about it? Or give a damn if they do?
I suppose not. He sipped down some more of his white wine.
Well, we keep plugging away, don't we?
It's funny, she went on. Not too long ago we fought wars which kept the population down enough that we couldn't damage the planet all that much. But now peace is breaking out all over, and we're advancing our industrial capacity. And so peace is destroying us a lot more efficiently than war ever did. Ironic, isn't it?
And modern medicine. The Anopheles mosquito was pretty good at keeping the numbers down. You know that Washington was once a malarial swamp? Diplomats deemed it a hazardous duty post. So then we invented DDT. Good for controlling mosquitoes, but tough on the peregrine falcon.
We never get it right.
Never. Mayflower concluded.
What if? She asked wistfully.
What if what, Carol?
What if nature came up with something to knock the human population back?
The Gaia hypothesis?
That made him smile. The idea was that the Earth was itself a thinking, self-correcting organism that found ways to regulate the numerous living species that populated the planet. Even if that's valid, and I hope it is, really, I'm afraid that we humans move too fast for Gaia to deal with us and our work. No, Carol, we've created a suicide pact, and we're going to take down everything else with us. And 100 years from now, when the human population worldwide is down to 1 million or so people, they'll know what went wrong and read the books and look at the videotapes of the paradise we once had,
and they'll curse our names. And maybe, if they're lucky, they'll learn from it when they crawl back up from the slime. Maybe. I doubt it. Even if they try to learn, they'll worry more about building nuclear power reactors so they can use their electric toothbrushes. Rachel was right. There will be a silent spring someday, but then it'll be too late.
He picked at his salad, wondering what chemicals were in the lettuce and tomatoes.
Some, he was sure. This time of year the lettuce came up from Mexico, where farmers did all sorts of things to their crops. And maybe the kitchen help had washed it off, but maybe not. And so here he was, eating an expensive lunch and poisoning himself, as surely as he was watching the whole planet being poisoned.
His quietly despairing look told the tale.
He was ready to be recruited, Carol Breitling thought. It was time. And he'd bring some good people with him. And they'd have room for them in Kansas and Brazil. Half an hour later, she took her leave and headed back to the White House for the weekly cabinet meeting.
"Hey, Bill," Gus said from his office in the Hoover Building. "What's happening?"
"Catch the TV this morning?" Henriksen asked.
"You mean the thing in Spain?" Werner asked.
"Yep."
"Sure did. I saw you on the tube, too."
"My genius act," he chuckled.
"Well, it's good for business, you know."
"Yeah, I suppose it is. Anyway, what about it?"
"That wasn't the Spanish cops, Gus. I know how they train. Not their style, man. So, who was it? Delta? SAS? HRT?"
Gus Werner's eyes narrowed. Now assistant director of the FBI, he'd once been the special agent in charge of the FBI's elite hostage rescue team. Promoted out, he'd been special agent in charge of the Atlanta Field Division, and now was the AD in charge of the new Terrorism Division. Bill Henriksen had once worked for him, then left the Bureau to start his own consulting company. But once FBI, always FBI. And so now Bill was fishing for information.
"I really can't talk much about that one, buddy."
"Oh?"
"Oh, yes.
Can't discuss," Werner said tersely.
"Classification issues?"
"Something like that," Werner allowed. A chuckle.
"Well, that tells me something, eh?"
"No, Bill, it doesn't tell you anything at all."
"Hey, man, I can't break the rules, you know."
"You always were a straight shooter," Henriksen agreed. "Well, whoever they are, glad they're on our side. The takedown looked pretty good on TV."
"That it did."
Werner had the complete set of tapes, transmitted via encrypted satellite channel from the U.S. Embassy in Madrid to the National Security Agency, and from there to FBI headquarters. He'd seen the whole thing, and expected to have more data that afternoon.
"Tell them one thing, though, if you get a chance."
"What's that, Bill?" was the noncommittal response.
"If they want to look like the local cops, they ought not use a U.S. Air Force helicopter. I'm not stupid, Gus. The reporters might not catch it, but it was pretty obvious to somebody with half a brain, wasn't it?"
"Oops," Werner thought. He'd actually allowed that one to slip through his mental cracks. But Bill had never been a dummy, and he wondered how the news media had failed to notice it.
"Oh?"
"Don't give me that, Gus. It was a Sikorsky Model 60 chopper. We used to play with them when we went down to Fort Bragg to play, remember? We liked it better than the Hueys they issued us, but it ain't civilian certified, and so they wouldn't let you buy one," he reminded his former boss.
"I'll pass that one along," Werner promised.
"Anybody else catch on to that?"
"Not that I know of, and I didn't say anything about it on ABC this morning, did I?"
"No, you didn't.
Thanks."
"So, can you tell me anything about these folks?"
"Sorry, man, but no. It's code word stuff. And truth is," Werner lied, "I don't know all that much myself."
"Bullshit," he almost heard over the phone line. It was weak. If there were a special counter-terror group, and if America had a piece of it, Sure as hell, the top FBI expert in the field would have to know something about it. Henriksen would know that without being told. But, damn it, rules were rules, and there was no way a private contractor would be let into the classification compartment called Rainbow, and Bill knew what the rules were, too.
"Yeah, Gus, sure," came the mocking reply.
"Anyway, they're pretty good, but Spanish isn't their primary language, and they have access to American aircraft. Tell them they ought to be a little more careful."
"I'll do that," Werner promised, making a note.
"Black Project," Henriksen told himself, after hanging up. "I wonder where the funding comes from." Whoever those people were, they had FBI connections, in addition to DOD. What else could he figure? How about where they were based? To do that... Yes, it was possible, wasn't it? All he needed was a start time for the three incidents, then figure when it was the cowboys showed up. And from that, he could make a pretty good guess as to their point of origin. Airliners traveled at about 500 knots, and that made the travel distance... Has to be England, Henriksen decided. It was the only location that made sense. The Brits had all the infrastructure in place, and security at Hereford was pretty good. He'd been there and trained with the SAS while part of the FBI's hostage rescue team, working for Gus. Okay, he'd confirm it from written records on the Bern and Vienna incidents. His staff covered all counter-terror operations as a normal part of doing business. And he could call contacts in Switzerland and Austria to find out a few things. That ought not to be hard. He checked his watch. Better to call right away, since they were 6 hours ahead. He flipped through his Rolodex and placed a call on his private line. "Black Project, eh?" he asked himself. He'd see about that. The cabinet meeting ended early. The president's congressional agenda was moving along nicely, which made things easy for everyone. They'd taken just 2 votes, actually mere polls of the cabinet members, since the president had the only real vote, as he'd made clear a few times, Carol reminded herself. The meeting broke up, and people headed out of the building. "Hi, George," Dr. Breitling greeted the Secretary of the Treasury.
"Hey, Carol. The tree's hugging back yet?" he asked with a smile.
"Always," she laughed in reply to this ignorant plutocrat. "Catch the TV this morning?"
"What about?"
"The thing in Spain."
"Oh yeah, World Park. What about it?"
"Who were those masked men?"
"Carol, if you have to ask, then you're not cleared into it."
"I don't want their phone number, George," she replied, allowing him to hold open the door for her. "And I am cleared for just about everything, remember?"
Sec-Trez had to admit that this was true. The president's science advisor was cleared into all manner of classified programs, including weapons, nuclear and otherwise. And she oversaw the crown jewel secrets of communications security as a routine part of her duties. She really was entitled to know about this if she asked. He just wished she hadn't asked. Too many people knew about Rainbow as it was. He sighed.
"We set it up a few months ago. It's Black, okay? Special Operations Group. Multinational. Works out of some place in England, mainly Americans and Brits, but others too. The idea came from an agency guy the boss likes. And so far, they seem to be batting 1,000, don't they?"
"Well, rescuing those kids was something special. I hope they get a pat on the head for it."
A chuckle.
"Depend on it. The boss sent off his own message this morning."
"What's it called?"
"Sure you want to know?" George asked.
"What's in a name?"
"True." Sec-Trez nodded. "It's called Rainbow. Because of the multinational nature."
"Well, whoever they are, they scored some points last night. You know, I really ought to get briefed in on stuff like this."
"I can help, you know," she pointed out.
So tell the boss you want in.
I'm kinda on his shit list now, remember?
Yeah, so dial back on your environmental stuff, will you? Hell, we all like green grass and Tweety Birds. But we can't have Tweety Bird telling us how to run the country, can we?
George, these really are important scientific issues I have to deal with, Carol Breitling pointed out.
You say so, Doc. But if you dial the rhetoric back some, maybe people will listen a little better.
Just a helpful hint, the Secretary of the Treasury suggested, as he opened his car door for the two-block ride back to his department.
Thanks, George. I'll think about it, she promised. He waved at her as his driver pulled off.
Rainbow, Breitling said to herself as she walked across West Executive Drive. Was it worth taking it a step further?
The funny part about dealing with classification issues was that if you were inside, then you were inside.
Reaching her office, she inserted the plastic key into her Stew-4 secure telephone and dialed up CIA on the director's private line.
Yeah? A male voice answered. Ed, this is Carol Breitling. Hi. How'd the cabinet meeting go?
Smooth, like always.
I have a question for you.
What's that, Carol? The DCI asked.
It's about Rainbow. That was some operation they ran in Spain last night.
Are you in on that? Ed asked.
How else would I know the name, Ed? I know one of your people set it up. Can't remember the name, the guy the president likes so much.
Yeah, John Clark. He was my training officer once, long time ago. Solid citizen. He's been there and done that even more than Mary Pat and I have.
Anyway, what's your interest?
The new tactical radio encryption systems NSA is playing with. Do they have it yet?
I don't know, the DCI admitted. Are they ready for prime time yet?
Should be in another month. E-Systems will be the manufacturer, and I thought they ought to be fast-tracked into Rainbow. I mean, they're out there at the sharp end. They ought to get it first.
On the other end of the line, the Director of Central Intelligence reminded himself that he should pay more attention to the work done at the National Security Agency. He'd allowed himself to forget, moreover, that Breitling had the black card clearance that admitted her into that Holy of Holies at Fort Meade.
Not a bad idea. Who do I talk to about that?
Admiral McConnell, I suppose. It's his agency. Anyway, just a friendly suggestion. If this Rainbow team is so hot, they ought to have the best toys.
Okay, I'll look into it.
Thanks, Carol.
Anytime, Ed. And maybe get me fully briefed into the program someday, eh?
Yeah, I can do that. I can send a guy down to get you the information you need.
Okay, whenever it's convenient. See you.
Bye, Carol.
The secure line was broken. Carol smiled at the phone.
Ed would never question her about the issue, would he?
She'd known the name, said nice things about the team, and offered to help, just like a loyal bureaucrat should.
And she even had the name of the team leader now, John Clark, Ed's own training officer once upon a time. It was so easy to get the information you needed if you spoke the right language. Well, that's why she'd gone after this job. Frustrations and all.
One of his people did the math and estimated the travel times, and the answer came up England, just as he'd suspected. The triangle of time for both Bern and Vienna both apexed at London, or somewhere close to it. That made sense, Henriksen told himself. British Airways went everywhere, and it had always had a cordial relationship with the British government. So, whoever it was, the group had to be based... Hereford. Almost certainly there. It was probably multinational. That would make it more politically acceptable to other countries. So it would be American and British, maybe other nationalities as well, with access to American hardware like that Sikorsky helicopter. Gus Werner knew about it. Might it have some FBI people in the team? Probably, Henriksen thought.
The hostage rescue team was essentially a police organization. But since its mission was counter-terrorism, it practiced and played with other such organizations around the world, even though those were mainly military. The mission was pretty much the same, and therefore the people on the mission were fairly interchangeable. And the FBI HRT members were as good as anyone else in the world. So probably someone from HRT, perhaps even someone he knew, was on the team. It would have been useful to find out who, but for now, that was too much of a stretch. The important thing at the moment was that this national counter-terror outfit was a potential danger. What if they deployed to Melbourne? Would that hurt anything? It surely wouldn't help, especially if there was an FBI agent on the team. He'd spent 15 years in the Bureau, and Henriksen was under no illusions about those men and women. They had eyes that could see and brains that could think, and they looked into everything. And so his strategy to raise the world's consciousness of the terrorist threat, and so help himself get the Melbourne job, might have gone an unplanned step further. Damn. But the law of unintended consequences could hit anyone, couldn't it? That's why he was in the loop, because it was his job to deal with the unintended things. And so here he was, still in the intelligence-gathering mode. He needed to learn more. The really bad news was that he had to fly off to Australia in less than a day, and would himself be unable to do any more gathering. Well, he'd have dinner tonight with his boss to pass along what he knew. And maybe that ex-KGB guy on the payroll could take it a little further. Damn sure he'd performed pretty well to this point. A pipe smoker. It never ceased to amaze Henriksen how such little things could break open a case. You just had to keep your head up and eyes open.
"The interleukin isn't doing anything," John Kilgore said, looking away from the monitor. The screen of the electron microscope was clear. The Shiva strands were reproducing merrily away, devouring healthy tissue in the process.
"So?" Dr. Archer asked.
"So that's the only treatment option I was worried about. 3A is an exciting new development, but Shiva just laughs at it and moves on. This is one scary little mother of a bug, Barb."
"And the subjects?"
"I was just in there. Pete's a goner. So are the rest. The Shiva's eating them up. They all have major internal bleeds, and nothing is stopping the tissue breakdown. I've tried everything in the book. These poor bastards wouldn't be getting better treatment at Hopkins, Harvard, or the Mayo Clinic. And they're all going to die.
Now," he allowed, "there will be some whose immune systems can deal with it, but that's going to be pretty damned rare."
"How rare?" she asked the epidemiologist.
"Less than 1 in 1,000, probably, maybe 1 in 10,000. Even the pneumonic variant of plague doesn't kill everybody," he reminded her.
That was about the most lethal disease on the planet, and allowed only 1 in 10,000 to survive. Some people, she knew, had immune systems that killed everything that didn't belong. Those were the ones who lived to 100 years of age or so. It had nothing to do with smoking, not smoking, having a drink in the morning, or any of the other rubbish they published in the papers as the secret of living forever. It was all in the genes. Some were better than others. It was that simple.
"Well, that's not really something to worry about, is it?"
"World population is between 5 and 6 billion now. That's a little more than 5 × 10⁹ people. Subtract 4 orders from that, and you have something on the order of 5 × 10⁵ survivors. Figure a few 100,000 who might not like us very much."
"Spread all over the world," Barbara told him. "Not organized. Needing leadership and scientific knowledge to help them survive. How will they even connect? The only 800 people surviving in New York? And what about the diseases that come with all those deaths? The best immune system in the world can't protect you against them."
True, Kilgore conceded. Then he smiled.
We're even improving the breed, aren't we?
Dr. Archer saw the humor of that.
Yes, John, we are.
So, Vaccine B is ready?
He nodded.
Yes, I had my injection a few hours ago. Ready for yours?
And A?
In the freezer. Ready for mass production as soon as people need it. We'll be able to turn it out in 1,000-liter lots per week when we have to. Enough to cover the planet, he told her. Steve Berg and I worked that out yesterday.
Can anybody else?
No way. Not even Merck can move that fast. And even if they did, they'd have to use our formula, wouldn't they? That was the ultimate hook. If the plan to spread Shiva around the globe didn't work as well as hoped, then the entire world would be given Vaccine A, which Antigen Laboratories, a division of the Horizon Corp, just happened to be working on as part of its corporate effort to help the Third World, where all the hemorrhagic fevers lived. A fortunate accident, albeit one already known in the medical literature. Both John Kilgore and Steve Berg had published papers on these diseases, which had been made quite high profile by the big scare America and the world had gone through not so long before. So the medical world knew that Horizon, Antigen, was working in this area, and wouldn't be surprised to learn that there was a vaccine in the works. They'd even test the vaccines in laboratories and find that, sure enough, the liquid had all manner of antibodies. But they'd be the wrong antibodies, and the live virus vaccine would be a death sentence to anyone who had it enter his system. The time from injection to onset of Frank's symptoms was programmed at 4 to 6 weeks, and again, the only survivors would be those lucky souls from the deepest end of the gene pool. 100 such people out of 1,000,000 would survive. Maybe less. Ebola Shiva was one nasty little bastard of a bug, 3 years in the making. And how odd, Kilgore thought, that it had been that easy to construct. Well, that was science for you. Gene manipulation was a new field, and those things were unpredictable. The sad part, maybe, was that the same people in the same lab were charging along a new and unexpected path, human longevity, and reportedly making real progress. Well, so much the better. An extended life to appreciate the new world that Shiva would bring about. And the breakthroughs wouldn't stop. Many on the select list to receive Vaccine B were scientists. Some of them wouldn't like the news when they were told, but they'd have little choice, and, being scientists, they'd soon get back to their work. Not everyone in the project approved. Some of the radical ones actually said that bringing physicians along was contrary to the nature of the mission, because medicine didn't allow nature to take her course.
Sure, Kilgore snorted to himself.
Fine. They'd let those idiots have their babies in farm fields after a morning's plowing or hunter-gathering, and soon enough those ideologues would breed themselves out. He planned to study and enjoy nature, but he'd do so wearing shoes and a jacket to keep the chill out. He planned to remain an educated man, not revert to the naked ape. His mind wandered. There'd be a division of labor, of course. Farmers to grow the food and tend the cattle they'd eat. Or hunters to shoot the buffalo, whose meat was healthier, lower in cholesterol. The buffalo should come back pretty fast, he thought. Wheat would continue to grow wild in the Great Plains, and they'd grow fat and healthy, especially since their predators had been so ruthlessly hunted down that they'd be slower to catch up. Domestic cattle would thrive also, but they'd ultimately be edged out by the buffalo, a much hardier breed better suited to free life. Kilgore wanted to see that, see the vast herds that had once covered the West. He wanted to see Africa, too.
That meant that the project needed airplanes and pilots. Horizon already had its own collection of G5 business jets, capable of spanning most of the world. And so they'd also need small teams of people to manage and maintain a few airports. Zambia, for instance,
He wanted to see Africa wild and free. That would take perhaps 10 years to come about, Kilgore estimated. And it wasn't all that big a deal. AIDS was killing off that continent at a nasty pace, and Shiva would only make it go faster. And so the Dark Continent would again be free of man, and he'd be able to go there and observe nature in all her glory. And maybe shoot a lion to make a rug for his home in Kansas. Some of the people in the project would raise pure fucking hell over that. But what was one lion, more or less? The project would be saving hundreds of thousands of them, perhaps millions, free to roam and hunt in their prides. What a beautiful new world it would be, once you eliminated the parasitic species that was working so hard to destroy it. A beeper went off. He turned to look at the control panel. It's Ernie, M5. Looks like cardiac arrest, he said. What are you going to do? Barbara Archer asked. Kilgore stood. Make sure he's dead. He bent down to select a camera for the big monitor on his desk. Here, you can watch. 2 minutes later, he appeared on the screen. An orderly was already there, but did little more than watch. She saw Kilgore check the man's pulse, then check his eyes. Despite having the B vaccine, Kilgore used gloves and a mask. Well, that made sense. Then he stood back up and switched off the monitoring equipment. The orderly detached the IV lines and covered the body with a sheet. Kilgore pointed to the door, and soon the orderly wheeled the gurney out, heading off for the incinerator. Kilgore took the time to look at other subjects, and even appeared to speak with one before leaving the screen for good. "I figured that," he said, returning to the control room without his protective gear. Ernie's heart wasn't all that good, and Shiva went right after it. Wendell's going to be next, M2. Maybe tomorrow morning. Liver function's off the chart, and he's bleeding out big time in the upper GI. What about the control group? Mary, F4, 2 more days, she's going to be in frank symptoms. So the delivery system works? Archer asked. Like a charm. Kilgore nodded, getting some coffee before he sat back down. It's all going to work, Barb, and the computer projections look better than our requirement parameters. 6 months from initiation, the world is going to be a very different place, he promised her. I still worry about those 6 months, John. If anybody figures out what's happened, their last conscious act will be to try and kill us all. That's why we have guns, Barb. It's called Rainbow, he told them, having gotten the best information of the day. It's based in England. It was set up by a CIA guy named John Clark, and he's evidently the boss of the outfit. That makes sense, said Henriksen. Multinational, right? I think so, John Breitling confirmed. Yes, Dmitry Popov said, picking at his Caesar salad. That is all sensible, some sort of NATO unit, I imagine, based at Hereford. Correct, said Henriksen. By the way, nice job figuring out who they were. Popov shrugged. It was simple, really. I ought to have made the guess sooner. My question now, what do you want me to do about it? I think we need to learn more, Henriksen said, with a glance at his boss. A lot more. How do you do that? Breitling asked. It is not difficult, Popov assured him. Once you know where to look, that is most of the battle. Once you know that, you merely go there and look. And I already have one name, do I not? You want to take it? John asked the Russian. Certainly. If you pay me to do so. There are dangers, but... What kind of dangers? I once worked in England. There is the possibility that they have a photograph of me under a different name, but I do not think that likely.
Can you fake the accent? Henriksen asked.
Most certainly, old boy, Popov replied with a grin. You at FBI once?
A nod.
Yep.
Well, then you know how it is done.
A week, I think.
Okay, Breitling said. Fly over tomorrow.
Travel documents? Henriksen asked.
I have several sets, all current and all perfect, the intelligence officer assured him. It was nice to have a pro on the payroll, Henriksen thought to himself. Well, I have an early flight, and I haven't packed yet, guys. See you next week when I get back.
Easy on the jet lag, Bill, John advised. The former FBI agent laughed.
You got a drug that works on that?
Chapter 18. Looks.
Popoff boarded the morning Concorde flight. He'd never flown the Concorde before, and found the interior of the aircraft cramped, though the legroom was all right. He settled into seat 4C. Meanwhile, at another terminal, Bill Henriksen was in a first-class seat in an American DC-10 for his trip to Los Angeles.
William Henriksen, Dmitri Arkadyevich Popov thought, formerly of the FBI's hostage rescue team, and an expert on counterterrorism, president of an international security consulting company now headed off to Australia to seek a consulting contract for the next Olympics. How did that factor into what Popov had been doing for John Breitling's Horizon Corporation? What exactly was he doing? More properly, what idea was he serving? What task? He was certainly being paid top dollar. He hadn't even raised the money issue over dinner because he was sure he'd get whatever he asked for. He was thinking in terms of $250,000 for this job alone. Even though it held few dangers, aside from driving an automobile in British traffic.
$250,000?
Maybe more, Popov told himself. After all, this mission seemed pretty important to them. How did an expert on the mission side of terrorism and an expert on counterterrorism factor into the same plan? Why had they so rapidly seized on his discovery that there was a new international counter-terror organization? It was important to them. But why? What the hell were they up to? He shook his head. He was so smart, yet he didn't have a clue. And he wanted to know, now more than ever. Again, it was the not knowing that worried him.
Worried?
Yes, he was worried now. The KGB had never encouraged curiosity, but even they knew that you had to tell intelligent people something. And so with mission orders had usually come some kind of explanation. And, at the least, he'd always known that he was serving the interests of his country. Whatever information he'd gathered, whatever foreign national he'd recruited, it had all been aimed at making his nation more secure, more knowledgeable, more strong. That the entire effort had failed was not his fault. The KGB had never failed the state. It had been the state that had failed the KGB. He'd been part of the world's finest intelligence service, and he remained proud of its abilities and his own. But he didn't know what he was doing now. He was supposed to gather information, and it was quite easy for him. But he still didn't know why. The things he'd learned at dinner the night before had merely opened another door into another mystery. It seemed so like some Hollywood movie of conspiracy, or some detective book whose ending he could not yet discern. He'd take the money and do the job, but for the first time he was uneasy, and the feeling was not a pleasant one. As the aircraft raced down the runway and took off into the rising sun for London Heathrow.
Any progress, Bill?
Tawney leaned back in his chair. Not much. The Spanish have identified two of the terrorists as Basque separatists, and the French think they have a line on another of their citizens at the park, but that's all. I suppose we could ask Carlos for some information, but it's rather doubtful that he'd cooperate. And who's to say that he even knew the buggers in the first place?
True.
Clark took a seat.
You know, Ding's right. One of these incidents was probably to be expected. But three, all in the brief time we've been here, seems like a lot. Is it possible that somebody is setting them loose somehow, Bill?
I suppose it's possible, but who would do it? And why would he do it? Tawny asked.
Back up. Stay with the who part first.
Who has the ability?
Someone who had access to them back in the 70s and 80s. That means someone well inside the movement, or someone who controlled them, influenced them from the outside.
That would mean a KGB type.
Notionally, this chap would be known to them, would have means to contact them, and thus the ability to activate them.
All three groups have been heavily ideological.
That's why the contact would have to be former, or maybe active, KGB. It'd have to be someone they trust. More than that, a person with the kind of authority they would recognize and respect.
Tawny sipped at his tea.
That has to mean an intelligence officer. Perhaps a fairly senior one with whom they'd worked back in the old days. Someone who interfaced with them for their training and support in the old East Bloc.
German? Czech? Russian?
Russian, Tawny said. Remember that KGB let the other Bloc countries support them only under their close direction. The standoff nature of the arrangement was always paper-thin, John. It was meant more for their own comfort than for anyone else's. Progressive elements and all that rubbish. They were usually trained outside of Moscow, and then quartered in safe houses in Eastern Europe, mainly East Germany. We got a good deal of material from the old East German Stasi when the DDR collapsed. I have some colleagues at Century House going back over the information right now. That will take time. It was, unfortunately, never computerized or even properly cross-referenced.
Funding problems, Tawny explained.
Why not go straight to KGB?
Hell, I've met Golovko.
Tawny didn't know that.
You're kidding.
How do you think Ding and I got into Iran so quick with a Russian cover? You think CIA can pull off an operation that fast?
I wish, Bill.
No, Golovko set it up, and Ding and I were in his office before we flew down.
Well, then, if you can, why not give it a try?
I'd have to get authorization from Langley.
Will Sergei actually cooperate?
Not sure, John admitted. Even money at best. But before I do such a thing, I'd need a good idea of exactly what I want. It can't be a fishing expedition. It has to be well-directed.
I can see what we might have on the name of an intelligence officer who worked with them.
Problem is, it won't be a real name, will it?
Clark nodded.
Probably not.
You know, we have to try harder to get one of these people alive. Kinda hard to interrogate a corpse.
That opportunity hasn't presented itself yet, Tawny pointed out.
Maybe, Clark thought.
And even if you got one alive, who was to say that he'd know what was needed?
But you had to start somewhere.
Bern was a bank robbery. Vienna was an attempted kidnapping, and from what Herr Osterman said, the subjects were after something that doesn't exist. Private insider computer codes into the international trading system. The most recent incident was something right out of the 70s.
Okay, two out of three were about money, Clark agreed.
But the terrorists in both those cases were supposed to be ideological, right?
Correct.
Why the interest in money?
In the first one, okay, maybe it was a straight robbery.
But the second one was more sophisticated.
Well, both sophisticated and dumb, because they were after something that doesn't exist. But as ideological operators, they would not have known that.
Bill, somebody told them to go after it. They didn't start that one by themselves, did they?
I agree. Your supposition is likely, the spook said.
Very likely, perhaps.
So, in that case, we have two ideological operators, technically fairly competent, but going after something that doesn't really exist. The combination of operational cleverness and objective stupidity just seemed